Your Bibles out this evening and turn them to Matthew, the fifth chapter. We'll begin reading in verse 33 in just a moment. We want to conclude our thoughts today on the subject of a marriage that will not fail. As we talked about this morning, we were talking about some principles. We were talking about some attitudes that must be followed in marriage to give us strong marriages that will not fail, marriages that will influence our children to live for what is right, and also be examples to those who are in the world to show that God does have a better plan. That God knows how this institution is to work, and following His pattern and His precepts can make it all that we would have it to be. This morning we discussed three. We talked about not murdering, and that is again with our mouth by the things that we say. We talked about not committing adultery, and then we ended by talking about that we do not divorce. We talked about not planting the seed, not talking about it. And it was pointed out to me this morning, and it's rightfully so, that there were no other reason that divorces would not be an option. One of the things that I think I would hope that we would consider are the children, because they are victims. They are victims in the selfishness of two people, of a man and a woman, that would take that route and would subject their children to the horrors of a broken home. And I've always heard the term an agreeable divorce. I don't know what that is. I wish someone would explain it to me. But in a divorce, no matter if it is for scriptural grounds, you have victims. And many times those victims are children, and they have scars that follow them through the rest of their lives. And so that's something that we should deeply consider when we are looking for a way to solve our problems and not jump out of the frying pan into the fire, so to speak. Let's continue tonight by looking first of all at verse 33. It says, again, you have heard it said of those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but perform your oath to the Lord. But I say to you, do not swear at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, nor by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you swear by your head, because you cannot make one hair white or black. Therefore, let your yes be yes, and your no be no, and for whatever is more of this is from the evil one. I want to talk to you tonight about avoiding deception. That is a trait that we must incorporate into our marriages. We must avoid deception. Now, what do I mean by deception? Well, what I mean by deception is that we try to hide what we're doing. We try to hide or deceive our mate in what we are doing and what we are thinking. The Bible says in verse 37, to let your yes be yes and your no be no. We need not to make a vow that we have no intentions of keeping it. I want you to take your Bibles and turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 5. I want you to listen to the wise man Solomon, who wrote many centuries ago about the danger of making rash vows. In Ecclesiastes the 5th chapter, I'm going to begin reading in verse 2. It says, do not be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart utter anything hastily before God. For God is in heaven, you are on earth, therefore let your words be few. For a dream comes through much activity, and a full voice is known by his many words. When you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. What I want you to see is we need to remember the vows that we made. One of the things that we said when we got married is that we were going to be faithful. One of the things that we promised was for richer or poorer, for better or worse, until death do we part. We made some serious promises. You didn't just make them to your wife. You didn't just make them to your husband. You made them to the God of heaven in his presence. You promised to do some things, and you promised to honor to do some things. And we must be faithful to that which we vow ourselves, or we promise ourselves to do. And we must be faithful to our commitment. When communication breaks down, and we cannot talk one to another, the marriage is sounding an alarm. When trust is broken or confidence, we will confide in somebody else. If your mate cannot confide in you, if they cannot talk with you, they will find someone else to talk to, and that is an alarm signal that we should be very concerned about. If you hide what you are doing and who you are with, then you better not do it. Let me give you a rule of thumb. If you can't tell your mate what you're doing, you don't need to be doing it. If you have to hide, if you have to worry about them finding out, you do not need to do that action. You need to do something about that, because that's deception. That's deceiving. And that will destroy your credibility, and that will destroy trust of your mate. They will not believe you. They will not put any confidence in the things that you say. And they will worry every time you're out of your presence what you're doing or who you're with or what you might be doing, because you have not been truthful with them. You have been deceptive. Ladies and gentlemen, the Bible tells us in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse number 25 that we are not to lie. Colossians 3 verse 9 says that put away lying, lie not one to another. How can I make a marriage work if there is no trust in the relationship? If my mate can't trust the things that I say, if my mate can't trust where I say I will be, then what does that do to the relationship? What it does is it begins to melt it down. My brother and sister in Christ, if you're doing anything that you don't want your mate to find out about, you better quit doing it. Because what you're doing, you're risking your marriage. You're risking the happiness of both of you by deceiving and being deceptive. That is a trait that will destroy your credibility and the trust that is so important in a relationship. One of the most vital aspects of marriage is trust. And when you begin to be deceptive and you deceive, then you're going to ruin that trust. And that's going to show itself in respect. Your mate's going to lose respect for you. They're going to lose love for you, and that will begin to deteriorate and erode the marriage. Avoid deception at all costs. Don't do anything that you can't tell your mate. Now, I know somebody's going to ask me about this. When I was in the last few years I was in the military, I was in a job that was a top secret job, and I worked at a site. Now, there were things that I could not tell my wife. I couldn't tell her where I worked, couldn't tell her what I did, couldn't tell her how far it was where I flew to work. I couldn't tell her any of that, because that was things that I was sworn to secrecy by my superiors. But there was a phone number that she could always call in case of emergency, and she could get a hold of me, and they would fly me back if I had to get back. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about something that we know is wrong, something that we know that would be very detrimental to our relationship, very detrimental to what my mate would think about me if they ever found out what was going on. Brethren, if you've got to do that, you better try to do something different, because that's going to destroy your marriage. Avoid deception. Another thing that we need to avoid is retaliation. Turn to Matthew, the 5th chapter, and look at verse 38 and 39. You have heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, resist an evil person. Whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn also to the other. We need to understand that this applies to physical and verbal abuse. A vindictive attitude leads to sin. We've got to avoid the desire to get even. When my mate does something that is unkind, something that hurts me, something that really gets beside me, the answer is not to return in kind. That just escalates the problem. That just makes the gap widen that is between us because of the action of one mate or the other. It is easy, and it is also the first thing we think about. When somebody lashes out at me, when somebody hurts me, then my human reaction is to lash out and to get even. The Christian must avoid that attitude. He must not seek to retaliate. Turn over to Romans, the 12th chapter. The Apostle Paul dealt with this in his letter to the church at Rome about how to overcome evil. And what we want to see here in Romans chapter 12 is he establishes some principles that we need to consider. In verse 17 it says, repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Beloved, do not avenge yourself, but rather give place to wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Therefore, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink, for in doing so, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. The attitude of getting even, to give one a taste of his own medicine, is going to backfire. Let me explain it this way. Why would you do something to someone that did it to you and caused you the pain and the hurt that you feel? How is doing the same thing to them going to make it better? Well, I'll feel better. You might temporarily, but you're going to inflict the same pain that they inflicted upon you. Now, if you don't like them to do it to you, then why would you turn around and do it to them? You see, that doesn't work. All that does is get the frustration out. It's another form of venting. It's another thing of just trying to get even because I've been hurt. Why would I treat one the way that I've been mistreated? I want to ask you an honest question. Does this help the problem or does it prolong it? Does it find a solution or does it widen the gap? Now it's easy, and it's not only easy, but in the heat of the moment, it is very easy to jump in without considering the repercussions. You remember what we talked about this morning? Do not murder. Think about what you're going to say before you say it. Practice self-control. This has a lot to do with retaliation. We have to be willing to suffer the wrong. I have said many times from this pulpit that Christians are not reactionary people. And what that simply means, brethren, is that my attitude and my actions is not dependent upon what you do. My actions and my reaction is based upon what God tells me to do. You may remember verse 18 in Romans 12, as much as lies within you, live peaceably with all men. What does that mean? Have you ever met someone that you can't live at peace with? I mean, no matter what you would do, or no matter what you did, they found fault and they wanted to be antagonistic. There are people like that. But as much as lies within me, I'm not going to do anything to antagonize them. I'm not going to do anything to cause a problem of vengeance or retaliation. I'm going to do what God commands me to do, no matter if you don't live up to your part of the bargain or not. And brethren, if that's true when we're dealing with our enemies, it's also true when we're dealing in our mates in our marriage. We need to understand that giving a person a taste of their own medicine is going to backfire. It's not going to fix the problem. It's not going to make you feel better. It may give you some temporary satisfaction. You can cut them like they cut you, but that doesn't fix the problem. And so we have to avoid the decision to retaliate. Remember how hard was it, do you think, for the Lord when he was hanging on the cross and they were spitting at him and they were reviling him and they were mocking him and they said, if you be Jesus Christ, come down off the cross and we'll believe. Every one of us in this audience know that he could have come off that cross. But you know, he practiced great self-control that he didn't. He stayed on that cross and he died because he knew that was his Father's will. He knew that was the remedy that man needed. And what I'm saying is, when we are cut and when we hurt, when our mate hurts us or when we hurt our mate, let us not escalate the problem. And that's what you do when you retaliate. You escalate it. And you know what? You never get to solve the problem because now you've got two problems. And then pride comes in. And we're going to wait and see who can last the longest. Who will say they're sorry first? Brethren, we need to avoid retaliation. If we didn't like it, you can guarantee your mate's not going to like it. And so avoid retaliation. It widens the gap. Why treat them the way that you've been mistreated? Doesn't make any sense, does it? Avoid conditional love. Turn to Matthew 5 and look at verse 43. Avoid conditional love. You have heard it said of old, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be the sons of your Father in heaven, for he makes his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sends the rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet your brethren only, what do more than others? Do not even the tax collectors do also? Therefore you shall be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. Now let me ask you a question. Why do people get married? Well, Keith, that's a silly question. People get married because they love each other. Well, that's what they think. But they claim to be in love. Now, I want to tell you something tonight. Any kind of love that you fall into, you can fall out of. Any love that you fall into, you can fall out of. If marriage, the love in a marriage is based on physical things, if they are based on things that change, that is conditional love. And that type of love will not last, will not endure, and will not make a person happy. If your love is based on some condition, what happens when the condition changes? What happens when the condition changes? Conditions can change. What happens if they change? Why do some get married? She's pretty. She's cute. She's beautiful. What happens when the blonde hair turns gray? What happens when the wrinkles get to be more than they were when you first married? What happens if she gets and you get a little bigger than you were when you first got married? Conditions change. Does that mean our love should change? If my love is based on physical things because of how they look, because of what they offer the relationship. Let's say one of the reasons that I'm attracted to my mate is because that there's so many things we can do in common. What if something happens in her life that she can no longer do those things? You like to go hiking. You like to go backpacking. She has an accident. She has a disease and she no longer can do that. You going to fall out of love with her? Got to fall out of love with him? What if the condition changed? If my love is based on condition, it is love that will not last and it will not endure. We must avoid conditional love. If you marry because they're rich, what happens if they become poor? Is that going to change the love that you have for that person? What if something happens beyond your control? Are you going to be able to accept it? We talked this morning about the woman that was in an accident, in a coma. If that would happen to your mate, would you see her through to the end? Would you see him through to the end? Would you have that kind of love that you would stand and you would take care of that person? Let me illustrate this in something that you all know about. Brother Charlie Mullins, Sister Ina just passed away. I was amazed by the care that Brother Mullins had for Ina. Every time that I went to the nursing home where she was, I knew that Charlie would be there. He spent 8 and 9 hours a day with her. He couldn't do much but just sit there with her. But he was with her every day. And he did that for years. You that know Brother Mullins know that he did that for years, and he wouldn't have not done anything different. Why did he do that? Because he loved Ina. And that was important to him. And her condition didn't change the love that he had for her. What kind of love do you have for your mate? Is it based on conditions? Is it based on what they can do for you now? What about if they can't do what they used to do? I know of a situation of a good friend of mine who used to live in Texas. And before, when they were first married, she was very energetic. They did a lot of things before the kids came along. Then they had a couple of kids, and then she got lupus. And then she couldn't do what she used to do. She was tired quite a bit. She couldn't be as active as she was. And her husband began to treat her very, very differently. And he would not accept her condition. Matter of fact, he's in the military, and he got an overseas assignment. One of the things that they ask you when you volunteer to go overseas is, does anybody in your family have any medical conditions? He wrote, no. She has lupus. That's a medical condition. Took her 10,000 miles away from her family. He'll never acknowledge in his mind that she's a sick woman. And she will not last. She will last years less because she tries to be what her husband wants her to be instead of what she's able to do. Brethren, that's conditional love, and that does not work. That does not work because conditions can change. 1 Corinthians 13, it talks about real love. You want to know what real love is? Read 1 Corinthians 13, 4 through 8. Ephesians 5 says, husbands ought to love their wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it. That's the type of love that we need to have. Now, what do you see, what do you think of when you see a man open the car door for his wife? Three things cross our mind. Number one, they're newlyweds. Number two, they got a new car. And number three, he's trying to get out of the doghouse. But you know what I'm trying to get at here is sometimes we change what we used to do. Why do we do that? We do that because we take each other for granted. Let me tell you a true story. A 40-year-old man was suffering his midlife crisis. He came and talked with the preacher about his problem. He had been married for 20 years and he found it no longer satisfying or fulfilling. Finally, he reached the bottom line. He says, "Preacher, I just don't love her anymore. What can I do?" Well, after a brief moment of reflection, the preacher decisively said, "As I see it, you only have one option." And the man perked up in anticipation because he felt that maybe the preacher would say that now he could divorce her and he could go look at that wilder side of life that he thought he had missed. And the preacher looked right at him and said, "The only thing I know that you can do is you've got to repent and you've got to start loving her again." And that's the right answer. You've got to repent and start loving her again because that's what you promised to do when you married them. Wonder if our wives, you know, I often hear about husbands getting concerned about the age process on their wives. I wonder if the husbands ever concerned they're aging too. We're aging, we're getting grayer, we're getting balder, we're getting bigger. We have that problem too. We still want our wives to love us, don't we? And we ought to do the same to our own mates. Brethren, conditions change. The longer you're married, you know the truth in that. You know that we change as human beings. We get older, we get frailer, we get more feeble. If our love is just based on what our mate can do for us, selfishly what we can gain out of it, and if my mate can no longer do those things, then my love will change. And if that's true, then your love is based on the wrong thing. Avoid conditional love. It will make you a very unhappy marriage partner. Love is something that endures no matter what the conditions are. That's how people stay married for 59, 60, 65, 70 years. Because even though they change, their love for one another doesn't change. That's the way God intended for it to be. Avoid conditional love. If I had the rest, we need to avoid hypocrisy. In Matthew 6, the first 8 verses, it deals with hypocrisy. It deals with the Pharisees who went in the marketplaces and in the street corners, and they put on their long robe, and they stood in the middle of the square, and they said these long prayers and for the praise of men. And you remember in verse 5 of the 6th chapter, it says, "And when you pray, you should not do what the hypocrites do. For they love to pray standing in the synagogue and on the corners of the streets, that they may be seen by men. Surely I say to you, they have the reward." What was Jesus saying? He's saying, if you want outward show and you're looking for the glory and the grandeur of men and the praise of men, you may get it, but that's as far as it's going. You're not going to get any glory and honor from me. Now, what am I mean? What I mean is we need to not put on a show. Avoid hypocrisy. Don't put on a show. We love each other. We hold hands. And when we get home, it's World War II. We're at each other's throats. You know who knows most about how much you love your mate? Your children. Wouldn't we be surprised if we would ask our children, "How much do you think mom loves dad? How much does dad love mom?" They know the truth, don't they? They live with us every day. They know how mom and dad love each other, and they know how they express that love. What would they say? What would they say? "We only fight at home. We're not going to fight in public." That would put a bad reflection on us. You're fighting in front of God. You're fighting in front of your children. What are you teaching them? What are you telling them? What are we exemplifying to them? You know what statistics tell us if they mean anything? You know what most abused children, you know what they turn out to be? Abusive parents. Why do they do that? Because that's what conditions they were raised in. If my children see me and my wife just constantly at each other's throat, just yelling and screaming, belittling, name-calling, what kind of view do they have of marriage? What are they going to think marriage is all about? If I'm a man and I'm a domineering sort of a man, and I want to put my wife in her place and I want to make sure she's always under my thumb, what am I teaching my children? What am I telling them about marriage? What kind of marriage are they going to have? Brethren, I can tell you from personal experience, it's frightful to me when I think about people that I've met over the years and people that have had problems have come to me. It is frightful to me to think what kind of marriages their children are going to have because of the example they saw in the home. You know what would be a terrible thing to me? You know what would be a shock of all shocks? If one of my children had ever made the statement, my son or my daughters would ever say that they didn't want to marry anybody like me. I'm going to tell you, that would cut me. If my daughter said, or my son said, I don't want to marry anybody like mom. I'm going to tell you, that would hurt. That would hurt. You know, we need to understand lessons we teach our children. Where do children learn the most about marriage? It's by watching mom and dad. If you brought candies and flowers home to your wife, before your wife would know that there's something wrong with your children, said, Dad must have done something. We laugh, but you know what? A lot of truth in what I'm saying, and you know that there is. Our children learn very quickly. They know very quickly. They understand very quickly whether or not, if I don't treat my mate, if I don't treat my wife, or I don't treat my husband the way that God says, and I put on a show here when I'm with the Christian, but in the home the truth is known, who are we fooling, folks? We're not fooling God. We're not fooling our children. And you know what? We're not fooling one of the other mates because somebody is resenting it. Somebody is resenting it and is eroding the love that's in that home. And if you erode the love in that home, it's going to begin to show itself. And when it begins to show itself, it's going to have a very distressful effect upon our children. But you know what? It even goes deeper than that. It begins to affect the society. Because those children are going to have their own home. And then they're going to affect their children. And it's an endless process. It's a cycle that we must stop. Some people think because two people are Christians and they have an ideal marriage, you need to think again. Because you're both Christians, that should be the best marriage on earth. Should be the best possible relationship that there should be. Two Christians married each other. But it's not always so. Let me ask you an honest question, ladies and gentlemen. If you went home and you sat down with your mate, and you asked them this question, are you happy? What kind of answer do you think you would get? I challenge you to do it. Go home and sit down with your mate and say, are you happy? Are you happy being my wife? Are you happy being my husband? Maybe we need to hear the answer to that question. We need to not put on a show. We need to have genuine love for one another that needs to be expressed. Truth will be known sooner or later. You can't hide forever. You can't run and hide because sooner or later the cream comes up to the top. Sooner or later you're going to make a mistake. You're going to do something of a nature that's going to be known by others, and then the truth's out. But you know what? The honesty compels me to tell you tonight, truth's already out. Because God already knows. You know what kind of marriage you have? God knows. You know that He knows. He knows what kind of marriage you have. It's what it ought to be. And we're not going to be fooling. Ladies and gentlemen, do not forget what I'm telling you. One day we're going to give an account for what we did as husbands, what we did as wives, what we did as mothers and fathers. We're going to give an account of what we did in that role. That's going to be part of our judgment. What kind of wife was I? What kind of husband was I? What kind of mother? What kind of father? I'm going to give an account someday. I'm going to give an account of how I raised my four children. Did I make mistakes? You know I did. If my children were here, they would tell you them because they know that I did too. Have I made mistakes as a husband? Yes, I have. I know that. I tried to learn from them. I tried to do better. But brethren, I understand that I'm going to give an account for that. And I need to avoid hypocrisy. If I've got problems with my marriage, deal with them. If there's things that need to be fixed, fix them. Fix them before it's too late. Brethren, I'm going to tell you the most terrible thing that we can deal with is regret. When your mate's gone, you can't fix it. You can't say you're sorry then. You can't undo it then. You need to do it before that happens. I talked to Brother Mullins this morning. I wasn't able to go to the funeral because I was out of town visiting my granddaughter. I called him this morning and I told him I was thinking about him, told him I'd be praying for him. He said, "You don't have to worry about me, Keith. We had 59 good years. I know that she's better off." Brethren, God did not intend marriage to be a long-chain relationship. God intended to be happy and fulfilling to both parties. And if you're not getting that out of your marriage, sit down with your mate and work it out. Because that's what God wants you to do. We need to avoid materialism. In Matthew, the 6th chapter, Jesus talks about this at great length. If there is one point that is going to destroy a lot of marriages, it is keeping up with the Joneses. Many people end up in a divorce court because their wants go beyond their means. Do you know what the average credit card debt is to an American family today? $15,000 to $27,000. What happens when that kind of debt mounts up in a marriage? It puts a strain on the marriage. It puts a strain upon the relationship. When our wants get ahead of our means, it makes a very difficult situation to face. You know why? Because we just got to keep on working to pay for everything that we want and everything that we got, and we don't have any time to spend together. We're always on the edge because we're worrying about this bill and that bill, and we're worried about taking care of this and taking care of that, and we're just working ourselves into the ground. But the other thing we're working into the ground is our marriage. We have no time for our mate. We have no time for our children. And the truth be known, we have no time for ourselves because we're so worried about keeping up with the Joneses. Brother, materialism kills a lot of marriages. Look at Luke chapter 12. And look at verse 15. Luke chapter 12, verse 15. "And he said to them, 'Take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of things he possesses.'" Think about the last part of that statement. You know, today the roles have changed. Most homes are a two-working family where both husband and wife work. And that in itself creates many problems. A wife's too tired to be a wife. She's too tired to be a mother. She's too tired to take care of the things that she needs to take care of. Now, I'm not here to debate about whether a woman can work outside the home. There's nothing simple about that. But I'm telling you, even though your roles have changed, God's responsibility of your roles have not changed. You still have the responsibility to be a husband and a wife, a mother and a father, no matter if you both work in the home or you work outside the home. You both have those roles, and you cannot delegate them to someone else. Husbands cannot delegate their role to their wives, and wives cannot delegate their roles to their husbands. God gave you those roles, and nobody can do those roles except us. I have a role as a husband and as a father, and I have that responsibility, and that can be delegated to no one. That is my responsibility. As the head of a home, I have the responsibility as a husband. As a father, I have responsibilities to raise my children. That cannot be delegated to my wife. That is my role. In the same manner, a wife has a role of being under subjection to her husband. She cannot delegate that to someone else. That's her role, and she must fill that role. I'm not going to talk about the roles of change. You may work inside the home, outside the home, but you still have those God-given responsibilities that get done. But if you're spreading yourself too thin, something's got to give. And what usually gives is a marriage, because we begin to be irritable with each other. We don't have time to be with one another. We don't have time to talk. We don't have time to communicate. We don't have time to be with ourselves. We don't have time to talk about things that are serious because we're always under the gun. We're always trying to get something done. You know what it's called? It's causing life, squeezing life out of you. When life is controlling you, brethren, things are out of balance. I control my life. When my life controls me, I need to step back and I need to make some readjustments because I am in control of my life. My life is not to control me. In Matthew, the 16th chapter, verse 24 through verse 26, Jesus said, "If a man will not deny himself, he cannot be my disciple." I want you to look at the next statement I make on this slide. I want you to think about it. I want you to think about it real hard, what it means. is pursuing the things that money can buy at the expense of what it cannot buy. Is that a profitable venture? If I have everything I want and I have everything I can buy, but I have bought it at the expense of my relationship with my mate, you made a bad bargain. You can have a lot of things, but if you have a miserable marriage, you paid a bad rate for it. I want you to think about it. We can, you know, this life makes it easy for us to have convenience at the tip of our fingers. We can have anything that our heart desires. Credit can be gotten and you can have anything. Even if you really can't afford it, if you go out and fill out an application, you can get it. Is all those things worth what money cannot buy? A loving wife, a loving husband, a loving father, a loving mother, a happy, God-filled home. Is it worth it? If you think it is, you're in for a sad awakening because it is not worth it. I would rather be a pauper and be happy than to be rich and be miserable. To me, that's an easy exchange. And so be careful of this. You know what the three leading causes to divorce is? Number two is money. Number three is family. And number one is sexual intimacy. But number two is money. And money puts a strain on the relationship. We need to live within our means. And we need to live by what we need and not what we want. You know what? I know my parents wanted to give me the things that they never had. I'm not sure that that was a good thing. And I benefited from that theory. I benefited from that theory. Because I know I had things in my life growing up that my parents never had. But I'm not sure that when I gave things to my children that I never had, but I'm looking back on it now in hindsight, I'm not sure that was so good. Because maybe I didn't teach them the value of things. Maybe I did not leave the lesson that I needed to in how they should value and what's really important. It's not the things that you have, it's what you, the people you are. You know, when I grow old, if the Lord allows me to grow old, the things that I bought with my money, they're going to fade, they're going to get broken, they're going to be away. But I want a relationship with my children. I want a relationship with my grandchildren. I want to have them around me when I die because they are important to me. But ladies and gentlemen, if you don't have any time for them now, the day will come when they'll have no time for you. And you have paid for what you wanted. You got what you wanted. But you paid more than you thought you were paying. Don't make the mistake. Too many people suffer miserably being alone because they didn't have any time but for what they wanted instead of what they needed. Don't make that mistake. Avoid petty criticism. Avoid petty criticism. Matthew 7 talks about constant complaining and bickering. Constant complaining and bickering is a wear on the mind. It builds, and what it does is it destroys relationship, especially in a marriage. You know what? We all have faults. We all got them. I remember a number of years ago, my aunt and uncle, my late uncle, were having some problems, and they went to a counselor that was a friend of the family. And he wanted them to write down on a piece of paper all the faults that they had. And so my aunt, she was very honest. She wrote down about 2 pages of faults that she thought she had that she could improve upon. And she showed it to the counselor. She looked at that list and thought, well, Mrs. Greer, that's really honest. I admire your honesty. Well, what do you have written down, Mr. Greer? And my uncle looked. She said, well, I don't have anything written down. I don't need to. Look at the list she's got. You know what the problem was? And I love my uncle. And my uncle was a good man. He had his faults. And one of them is that he wasn't real honest with what was really wrong. But he corrected that later in his life. But you see, brethren, we all have parts. You know what? It is easy to pick one another apart. That's easy. And when you're married, it's really easy. You know why it's really easy when you're married? Because when you live together, you learn everything there is about each other. You know all the good and you know all the bad. And you know all the little things in their life that nobody else knows but you. But you know. But remember, she knows too. And you know what? We can just pick each other apart We can just nag ourselves into the grave. And ladies are not the only ones that can nag. Husbands are pretty good at that too. They can nag. They can go on and on and on. We can do that too. But you know what? Petty criticism will destroy love. Constant complaining, constant bickering, constant criticism. I'm not talking about constructive criticism. I'm just talking about constant criticism. Always complaining, never building up. If I were to ask you wives, husbands, when is the last time you complimented them, what would they tell me? If I were to ask the husband, wives, when's the last time you complimented them, would they have to think? Well, I think he did a couple of years ago. When's the last time we just complimented our mate? We can always find something wrong. But constant complaining is going to tear down relationships. Proverbs is full of the dangers of contention and strife. Brethren, what it does is it erodes love. Constant bickering, constant criticism erodes love, it erodes respect, and it erodes a marriage. Now, I'm not saying, and don't get me wrong, that if we got problems in marriage, we need to deal with them. But if there are things that I could really live with, I mean, I may not do them. If it was up to me, I might not do them that way. But if my mate likes to do them that way, if I love her, and it really doesn't amount to anything except that I disagree, that I wouldn't do it that way, why not just accept it instead of causing a problem in marriage? Why not accept the person? Over and over, I've heard the statement made that I think my husband or my wife is trying to remold me. You didn't get married to remold your mate. When you married your mate, there was something about her, something about him that drew you to them. And that person was what you were drew to. If you were drawn to a project that you were going to remake him or you're going to remake her and you're going to make them better, you know what you found out? That didn't work. You found out that didn't work, didn't you? We don't marry our mate for what we can make them. We marry our mate because we love who they are. Constant bickering will destroy a marriage. How many of us have read this rule? I want you to take your Bibles and I want you to look at it. How many times have we talked about this rule? Matthew 7 and verse 12. We call it the golden rule. Therefore, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets. You know what? That's called the golden rule. And you know what? It needs to be practiced in marriage. It's not just for people in the world. Doing others, it's not just people in the world. It's marriage. How many marriages would be better if people practiced the golden rule? Do unto my wife as I would want my wife to do unto me. If I don't want my wife to belittle, if I don't want my wife to humiliate me, if I don't want my wife to be unkind to me, if I don't want her to be ugly to me, doesn't it make sense that I not be unkind, not be ugly, not be hateful to her? Doesn't it make sense? If I don't want them to treat me that way, then don't treat them that way. Doesn't that make sense, brethren? I think that not only makes God sense, that makes common sense. Why doing to somebody what I do not want them to do to me? You know, the golden rule is this not for people in the world. It's to be practiced in marriage. If I want my mate to be honest, if I want my mate to be trustworthy with me, if I want my mate to be able to talk to me, if I want my mate to have confidence that she can come to me about anything in her life, then I must reciprocate. I must be the same way. Brother, too many marriages are uneven. Too many marriages are too tilted one way or the other. And that kind of marriage is not going to be a happy marriage. It's not going to be a successful marriage. And it's not going to demonstrate in the home what a true marriage in God's eyes is. In order for a marriage to work, then it must be, we must treat our spouse the way that I like to be treated. Brethren, if you don't want your wife to humiliate you in public, don't you humiliate her in public. If you don't want your wife to call you a name, then don't you call her a name. If you don't want your wife to say cunning and hard things to you, then don't you do it to her. Brethren, just ask yourself, how many marriages would be better if people just practiced this? How many marriages would be better if people treated people just like they wanted to be treated? How stronger would our marriages be if we treated each other the way that we want to be treated? I think you know the answer to that. I think you know that if people treated me, if my wife treated me the way that I want to be treated, and I treated her the way that I want her to treat me, then we're going to be pretty happy. But sometimes we think our mate should do take what we want to give them, but if they would reciprocate the other way, we would get kind of angry about that. You know, if I humiliated my wife in public, maybe I wouldn't think anything about it, but if she did that to me, I'd get pretty irritated, wouldn't I? I feel that she tried to put me in my place and she did not show the proper respect. But ladies and gentlemen, when I did it to her, I did the same thing. I did the same thing. You know, I cringe. I cringe when I see men and women humiliating each other in public. And yes, Keith's been guilty of that. I've done that. I've not thought before I spoke. I did something in haste. Yeah, I've done that. But I tell you, I try to learn from it because it's hurtful. Now, if I don't want that kind of treatment by Rita, then I'm going to have the same respect for Rita. And I'm not going to be able to treat her that way. Now, brethren, I want you to I'm going to challenge you today. I want to challenge you in your marriages to practice this. Practice this golden rule and see if your marriage does not improve. Treat each other the way that you would want to be treated. And you will see a change in your marriage. And you will see a change for the better. You will see a change for the better. Please take your song books out and turn to the song that's been selected. God designed that we should have a happy home. Despite popular belief by the feminist movement, God did not make marriage a strictly man-oriented benefit. Marriage was to be an equal opportunity for both man and woman and to make men and women better together than they were alone. I, for one, believe God knew what He was doing. I am thankful and I am grateful for God that He created woman. I am grateful that He instituted